When life is going well, it's just not terribly pleasant to think about times when things could go horribly wrong. But the place we live dictates a certain level of preparedness. We live next to the Cascadia subduction zone, so an earthquake is a probability. Wildfires can start in our forested landscapes, unless they're really wet, in which case floods could happen. Let your imagination run wild on other possible disasters, and then engage your imagination on how to prepare for any of those. That is the function of an emergency preparedness summit set for this Thursday in Eugene at Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. The Ambulatory Surgery Center is putting this on. Rob Schwartz is the executive director there and one of our guests here on the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, Rob.
Good morning.
Sandy Doughton is with us as well. She's a science writer for the Seattle Times. Sandy, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
She'll be one of the speakers at the conference. And then Bill Loki is with us as well. He's senior program manager of the company Witt O'Brien's. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Rob, you've been here before. Would you give us the quick description of the Ambulatory Surgery Center and why you're holding the conference?
The Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association, also known as OASCA, represents the ambulatory surgery centers in the state of Oregon. And we have witnessed, along with many of your listeners, earthquakes, twisters, floods, and we also read the wonderful and disturbing book by Sandy that more is coming. And you don't prepare for the flood or the rainstorm after, you prepare before. And this is all about making sure that our surgery centers are prepared to be able to care for people in need if, God forbid, something bad happens.
And Bill Loki, I want to turn to you next as Senior Program Manager at Witt O'Brien's. What is Witt O'Brien's?
It's a consulting firm that, in my part of it, we provide disaster preparedness, response, and recovery services to public and private clients. The Witt part of it is from James Lee Witt, the director of FEMA under Bill Clinton, who's a former, he's chairman of the board now, but and the O'Brien's part of it that we merged together last year, mainly big in oil spill response and various software solutions for planning and disaster response.
So does Witt O'Brien's advise governments in addition to businesses? You said public and private.
Yes, we've done a number of contracts around the country with a variety of states and local governments, both helping them prepare for disaster, train for disaster, and helping them in the recovery process with both planning and navigating through federal recovery programs.
Sandy Doughton, I want to turn to you at the Seattle Times. Tell us about your work. You apparently were headed for a science career yourself, but ended up a science journalist instead. How'd that happen?
Well, I guess I found that I didn't quite have the personality it takes to really delve into a scientific topic in great detail and stick with it. I much prefer being able to learn about a lot of different subjects, which a job as a science writer allows me to do.
We do talk to scientists here and there, and you obviously talk to many. So let's focus first on this issue of a big earthquake. You've written a book about this as well. So, how big a quake are we talking about and how soon?
Well, as you said in your introduction, we're subject to a lot of different kinds of natural disasters here in the Northwest. But our biggest natural disaster is going to be the next earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone, this 700-mile-long fault that runs off the coast of the Pacific Northwest. And when that thing rips, I mean, we're going to see an earthquake and a tsunami very, very much like the one that Japan saw in 2011, a magnitude 9 quake, tsunamis of 30 feet, maybe even higher.
You've been at this long enough, obviously, to write a book about it, but was there a series of findings that turned us toward this conclusion? Because it seems like it's only within the last decade or two that we've finally really taken this turn toward, yes, there will be one again.
That's right, because for a long time, people didn't really think that this fault off the coast, this subduction zone, was active and dangerous. A lot of people argued that it couldn't produce big earthquakes, and it's only been in the last 20 or 30 years that people have found evidence that, yes, indeed, it has produced, depending on which data you look at, between 20 and 40 of these very powerful earthquakes in the last 10,000 years, and that leaves no doubt that it will happen again.
And in fact, the last one they were able to figure out because of a phantom tsunami that appeared in Japan. It was the end of January 1700, wasn't it?
Correct. The 314th anniversary of that quake was yesterday, January 26th. And they were able to put an exact date and time on it because January 26, 1700 is when it occurred. And they were able to figure out that date because even though, you know, there were people living here in the Northwest at that time, the Native Americans, they didn't leave any written records. But the tsunami created by that earthquake was so big that it crossed the Pacific and hit Japan, where people have been, you know, keeping records on earthquakes for more than 1,000 years. So people in Japan noticed that tsunami, that strange tsunami. They called it an orphan tsunami because they hadn't felt the quake. And from the Japanese records, they were able to determine that the quake hit here on January 26, 1700 at 9 p.m.
So this is an even more timely discussion than we thought. We will talk more with Sandy Doubt of the Seattle Times, Bill Loki at Witt O'Brien's, and Rob Schwartz from the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association about emergency preparedness on the eve of this Emergency Preparedness Summit coming to Springfield on Thursday. You may have lots of questions and comments about getting ready for various disasters. Join us on The Exchange when we come back from this break. We'll provide the phone numbers then, and we'll come back and talk to Rob, Sandy, and Bill and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about emergency preparedness, how to get ready for a major event. We are in a place that is earthquake-prone, wildfire-prone, flood-prone. All sorts of things can happen, and that does only include the natural stuff. There's also the possibility of things like terrorist attack. How do we prepare for these? That's the major question at an emergency preparedness summit set for Springfield Thursday, 8 to 4 at Sacred Heart at Riverbend. You can join us on The Exchange to talk about emergency preparedness now. Let's talk about your ideas, things you have experienced, things that have worked, things that didn't perhaps. 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Our guests are Rob Schwartz from the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. He's the executive director. Sandy Doughton is a science writer from the Seattle Times. And Bill Loki is the senior program manager at Witt O'Brien's. I want to come to you, Rob Schwartz. In your line of work, then, I mean, we can assume, can't we, that surgery centers will be busy?
Could you repeat the question? I had a problem with my phone.
Okay. The assumption is that in the event of a major emergency, that ambulatory surgery centers would be quite busy.
Absolutely. I think the first statement I would make is after Katrina, I was asked by the National Association to go to New Orleans and to interview people. What I found was that the surgery centers were totally unprepared. From a structural standpoint, from a staffing standpoint, and for us to be prepared and busy post an event, we need to make sure that we're prepared in advance in terms of making sure there are strategies to have staffing, supplies, making sure that the physical structure is safe and can be made safer. So that's part of the focus of this summit, and I want to add, Sandy's book is a page turner. I did not know about it. I was in Powell Books and saw it, started thumbing through it, and it was chilling. And I think it's a must read for anyone who cares about surviving a massive earthquake.
Sandy, do you go into specific scenarios about things that might happen in the event of an earthquake, what the landscape might look like and what services might look like or the lack thereof?
Well, there have been a lot of scenarios and analyses done, and two of the most recent ones are what are called resilience plans that were prepared by both the state of Washington and the state of Oregon. And these plans, for the first time, really look beyond the immediate aftermath of the earthquake to the long-term impacts on our economy, on our transportation network, on our communications. In the immediate aftermath of one of these quakes, Communications are going to be down. Many roads, many bridges will be out. Power will be out in a lot of places. Sewer and water systems will be so damaged that it will take months to years for them to come back online. So the destruction and the devastation from one of these mega quakes and tsunamis is just going to be devastating. But by, as Rob said, thinking now about what's going to happen, we can get ourselves in a better position to not only be able to ride out the immediate disaster, but for the region to bounce back economically as well.
Bill Loki at Widow Brian's, when Rob was talking about the examination of ambulatory surgery centers that were hit in New Orleans and environs by the major hurricanes, when you get a chance at Widow Brian's to go over disaster plans with people, what have you found over the years that tends to be the thing, the most obvious thing that is not done?
Well, I think before I joined Widow Brian's, I had a 30-year career at local, state, and federal government in emergency management. And I think if I would sum most of it up, is just the simple statement that most disaster problems are management problems, not skills problems. I've been in a number of responses from 9/11, Northridge earthquake, and things like that, and also, you know, been in long-term recovery. And it seems like, you know, I think teachers know how to be teachers. Firefighters know how to be firefighters. You know, people usually know their job, and that's not usually the problem. It's just this very complex environment, if you will, after the disruption of a major event, that it's management issues of such things as just communications among the different players that get involved that maybe not are involved day to day, or even questions on who's in charge here and things like that. And that's where events like this conference is coming up. We can explore both best practices, lessons learned, you know, what the laws and regulations tell us we ought to do, and engage in the discussion on how we can improve things both on a personal level and on an organizational level.
So it sounds like it's a pretty good idea to get together once in a while, at least compare some notes, make sure you can work on the same radio frequencies, things like that.
Well, disaster response is a team sport, and just, I mean, it tends to bring together a lot of strangers and a lot of agencies that, you know, in doing their day-to-day job might not interact very much. And so as much as you can engage in those management issues ahead of time, I've seen communities that have done that have done better in both their initial response and their long-term recovery than those that have not focused on things like that.
Not surprising, when we talk about the possibility of major disaster and recovery from it, we get a few phone calls. There are several waiting. Let's start with Joe in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Loki, Sandy Doughton, and Rob Schwartz.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Just fine.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for having this show, number one. Number two, I can't imagine the scenarios that you folks have to think about that can happen, especially in an earthquake or all the stuff that you're talking about. I work up in the mountains, and you know, my job site is up high in the hills, and even just after a simple windstorm, I'll get trees that fall down, and so I carry a chainsaw with me to make sure that I can clear my way. And I guess what I want to say is that I think everybody, on a personal level, you mentioned that, should have the concept of personal survival in the midst of even the simplest things that can occur. Does that make sense? I think
it does, absolutely. And Bill Loki, yeah. This is really where it starts, isn't it? Each person needs to think individually about what they would do.
Yes, it's very important to have a personal plan and a family plan. And I think the concept of General Russell Honoré, who led the military response in Katrina, he called it developing a culture of preparedness, which often we get away from with everybody used to cell phones working and turn on the switch and the light comes on and things like that. So just giving some thought about it. And the best way people learn is getting people talking about it. And, you know, you can put out all the brochures you want and things like that. But if you can get people at their workplace and around the dinner table talking about how we intend to behave when some bad things happen, you can, you know, start on this getting better prepared than if you just, you know, assume that nothing's ever going to happen to you and it's not going to impact you if it does.
Sandy Doughton from the Seattle Times. Go ahead. Yeah, exactly. I wanted to come to you next.
The standard advice used to be that, you know, everybody should be prepared to, you know, sort of make it on their own with enough food and water, et cetera, for about 3 days. But the more people look at the type of damage that's going to occur in one of these megaquakes and tsunamis, the more they're realizing that 3 days might not be enough because, you know, particularly in areas out on the coast are going to be just completely cut off. And people out there are going to have to be able to survive on their own for, you know, maybe a week or more before help gets to them.
Yeah, people should remember that U.S. 101, for example, which is the main artery on the coast, is prone to slides already just in very rainy conditions. So imagine those hillsides got a good shaking. What might happen to 101? In fact, I can remember periods when 101 was closed between Gold Beach and Port Orford for weeks at a time because of bad slides. We're talking about emergency preparedness in the context of an emergency preparedness summit coming up later this week in Springfield, hosted by the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. Rob Schwartz is the executive director there, and one of our guests, Sandy Doughton, you just heard from the Seattle Times, will be one of the speakers. It will also include Bill Loki, the senior program manager at Witt O'Brien's. You can join this discussion on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Dawn and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rob, Sandy, and Bill.
Hi. I find it ironic that that you're having this meeting at our main health care provider location in Springfield. A little background. My father survived the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, and he used to talk about it a lot. They lost their house, I was actually in charge of, I was the director of planning for Santa Fe, New Mexico, when a developer proposed a school that was under the floodplain. We were able to stop that by, you know, a little obvious planning. And I have a question for you, and something that's really bothered me for a while, and that is, why was the Sacred Heart River Bend Hospital placed where it is, which seems vulnerable to the loss of a dam, which might be the result of the average earthquake. And is anybody prepared to answer why the hospital was placed in such a perilous position?
Nobody from the hospital here, but let's see if Rob Schwartz might have some clues there. Thanks for the call, Don.
I really don't know why the hospital was built there. I think kind of anticipate and move beyond the question, one of the things that we are pushing our members to do, and we're surgery centers, not hospitals, is to conduct an audit. We have materials we're going to be handing out to really take a hard look at whether they're prepared. The combination of doing that audit and what both Bill and Sandy have been talking about, dialogue, the more talking and the more preparing, I can't emphasize it enough. And I want to note, we also manage the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association in Colorado. It's not on the coast, but they had what they called a 100-year flood this past summer. A freak rainstorm that just didn't move off the mountain range, and the waters came tumbling down. And hospitals and surgery centers were put out of commission, and a number of people died. So it's not just the mega earthquake. There are other things that can happen that can really set back a community in significant ways.
Don's question brings something to mind, Bill Loki, which is, with all your years of experience in emergency management at several levels of government and now at Witt O'Brien's, how much over the years have things like planning processes adapted to the knowledge of things that could go wrong?
Well, I think, at least when I started in the business with the state of Washington in the 1970s, I'll use my own community in Pierce County, Washington. There were mobile home parks in most every low place along the Puyallup River that just flooded every year. But zoning and codes and things like that permitted that Well, over time, with especially incentives in the flood insurance program and things like that, they were finally moved, and you know, it took a while, but now with good planning and the zoning and codes, you can keep people away from floodplains, away from landslide areas and things like that. I think with the increasing acceptance of government responsibility for things, that there's been a lot of progress in that at local government and state government and national government in knowledge and code requirements and things like that.
Here's another call from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about emergency preparedness with Bill Loki, Sandy Doughton, and Rob Schwartz.
Hello. I survived the Great Landers earthquake in the Mojave Desert. Thank God there were one-story old cabins and sparse population, but I did see the street shift like 4 feet away, a little one-lane street. I'm wondering about the recent earthquake in Gold Beach. I heard everything from 3.4 to 3.9. I'm wondering, does that give you new information about the Cascadia Fault and activity there?
That
and
is
also, I've always wondered about the Great Fault Line in the bottom of Klamath Lake. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeannie. Appreciate it. As a Sandy Doughton, I'm going to throw that one to you because there was an earthquake reported with Agnes, Oregon, just upriver from Gold Beach as its epicenter, somewhere in the low threes. But apparently some other activity along the fault line in recent weeks. Can you expand on that at all with any knowledge you might have?
Well, I think, you know, we get a lot of small quakes in the Northwest all the time. I mean, we're in a part of the world where we are being squeezed by the convergence of these big tectonic plates. We've got this big plate off the coast that's kind of pushing us to the east, and then we've got California moving up along the San Andreas, pushing us to the north. So we're getting pushed from a lot of different directions, and that's why we get so many of these small earthquakes. I don't think any of these recent small earthquakes were actually out on this big fault offshore, and that's one of the interesting things about this fault is that it has been so quiet for so long. And you might think that's good, but it's actually not. It's an indication that it's locked tight and building toward another big quake. Jeannie was interested in the situation at Klamath Falls, and I know there was a pretty big earthquake, I think one of the biggest in Oregon's history there.
21 years ago, and it did things like damage the county courthouse beyond repair.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And that, so in addition to this big fault off the coast, because we're being squeezed and shoved, we have a lot of faults on land, and that earthquake was on one of these faults, which can be, you know, quakes on those smaller faults can be very devastating when they happen sort of right under a city.
Let's take another call. We have Steve and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sandy Doughton, Rob Schwartz, and Bill Loki.
Howdy. Around Katrina, I started wondering what's worse could happen in Eugene. And after looking at a topo map, I decided it would be if Hills Creek Dam above Oak Ridge, which is an earth-filled dam, by the way, should give, it would come right down into Lookout Dam, which is a pretty big, impressive smack dam, and that would take out the Dexter Dam, and you'd have three dams coming down on Eugene. Register Guard estimated it would be a 50-foot wall of water. And how can anybody evacuate 200,000+ people living in the floodplain and the amount of time that you'd have to deal with this kind of a thing? And secondly, I don't think you'd have an ambulatory surgery center left if 50-foot of water hit River Bend, which is right on the banks there, so...
Okay, so the wall of water that you foresee coming in the event of...
Water, logs, houses, cars...
Boulders, you name it, yeah. All right, thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. Who wants to take that one on? Sandy Doughton, let me turn to you. Have you done much examination of Willamette Valley dams or have the resiliency plans for Oregon taken a look at the viability of those?
You know, I suspect those plans have, but I haven't delved into them in much detail. But the thing about one of these big megaquakes is that the ground is going to shake for a very long time, between 3 and 5 minutes of ground shaking, which is just unheard of because in your average earthquake, the ground shakes for about 30 seconds. Now, I don't know anything about those specific dams and whether, you know, that duration of shaking will be dangerous to them. But that's something that, you know, you could probably find out from the operators of the dam, what sort of earthquakes they were built to withstand.
Okay, we'll pick up the conversation about emergency preparedness on the other side of a break. Sandy Doughton, Rob Schwartz, and Bill Loki are guests. You can join us as well back on the exchange with our guests and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about emergency preparedness, how to get ready for a big earthquake or flood or wildfire, terrorist attack, you name it. These are all topics that will be discussed this week at an emergency preparedness summit set for Springfield, Sacred Heart at River Bend, Thursday 8 to 4. The Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association is one of the hosts. Rob Schwartz is its executive director and one of our guests. Two of the speakers from the summit are also with us. Sandy Doughton is a reporter from the Seattle Times and the author of Full Rip 9.0, The Next Big Earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. Bill Loki is the senior program manager at the preparedness company Witt O'Brien's. You can join us on the exchange. Let's talk about how to get ready for a major disaster and dislocation. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Sandy, maybe you can clarify this. We had Carter in Wolf Creek left a message wanting us to point out clearly we are on the Cascadia subduction zone, not next to it, as I have been saying. Which is the truth there?
Well, the Cascadia subduction zone is a three-dimensional structure. A lot of times on maps you will see it indicated as a line off the coast. And that line represents the place where these two tectonic plates meet. And that sort of seam is about 50 miles offshore. But the interface between those plates extends under the continent as well. So indeed, we are on top of the Cascadia subduction zone.
Fair enough. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking emergency preparedness.
Morning. This is nothing flip today. Sorry, there's nothing flip about any of this. Honestly, if a person really thinks about this and or some of the other issues that we can face, you need to be ready for about 6 months, and that's just reality. When you look at something as major an event as this. You're looking at the highways being knocked out, the rail lines being knocked out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it's going to take a long time to bring that infrastructure back, let alone hospitals built, in floodplains. The bottom line is that if that does happen, you need to be ready for it, not sounding like some foaming in the mouth prepper or something like that. On the other hand, one of the things that I can say, after every fire that I've seen in Josephine County where people have had to evacuate, most recently the Williams fire, it has been remarkable how everybody in the community pulls together to get the animals safe, to get the people safe, and to save as much property as possible. We are a remarkable group of people here in this region. So that's pretty much what I have to say. 6 months at a minimum.
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Paul. Appreciate that. Sandy Doughton, from your knowledge of the resiliency plans, how long can we expect some services to be out, like electricity, like cell phone, like some of the other ones you mentioned, and that we depend on?
Well, it varies from place to place, and the Oregon Resilience Plan in particular sort of divides the state into three regions. There's the coastal zone where not only will the tsunami hit, but the shaking will be strongest, and that's the area that's going to have the most damage, that's going to take the longest to repair. The kind of valley zone to the east of that, where most of the cities are, is won't be shaken quite as hard, but there's a lot more infrastructure there that could be damaged. And, you know, I mean, people, Oregon's highways and bridges are in really bad shape. And when you think about, you know, 20 major bridges going down, huge stretches of freeway being damaged, you know, it just makes sense that it's going to take years to repair all of that damage. Now, you know, things like electricity and water, you know, away from the coast, I think the expectation is that within, you know, weeks that should be back, you know, to at least some semblance of normality, or at least some basic level of service. But when you have water systems and sewage systems damaged by the shaking, those are going to take years to fix as well.
Bill Loki, can I assume that by the time you left government employed, before you and made your transition to Whit O'Brien's, that lots of changes had been made in plans to acknowledge the fact that we live in a zone where earthquakes are likely?
Well, I think oftentimes we're crisis reactive as a species and as a culture too. But after some of the major disasters like Katrina, a lot more effort was put into catastrophic planning, trying to get people thinking and engaging about not only these major events with examples like Katrina and other, you know, and Sandy and some other, you know, big disasters like that, it's not just, you know, fix it back and everything's going to be okay. And I think especially with the leadership at FEMA now, it's a lot more thoughts going into this. So but you still got to be prepared, as a couple of the callers have said, to be prepared to be on your own. There are limitations to what government can do. And another comment the caller made about that, you know, disasters often do bring out the best in people, pulling together, communities pulling together, strangers helping strangers. And we just, you know, if something like this happens, we're just going to all have to, you know, work together to solve it. But it's still got to, you know, people got to know it's going to take time for the potential damages to, you know, get things back not to normal, but to a new normal that, you know, a major disaster like this is going to cause in our communities.
Do you recommend, Bill, some planning as neighbors? In other words, like if, you know, you got three good friends in the neighborhood, like, okay, I'll stockpile the water, you stockpile the food, and I'll stockpile the generator and gasoline, something like that?
Well, just there's been a big effort ever since 9/11 with Homeland Security of, you know, neighborhood preparedness, community emergency response teams, a lot of volunteer things have been organized all over the country. And so any kind of thing, and where, you know, combining what you might do with law enforcement with neighborhood watch, you know, with, you know, finding out neighbors that might be, you know, elderly or going to need a little help, talking about that ahead of time can only help.
Let us take some more calls. Grumpy John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking emergency preparedness.
I would like to know what they are doing about monitoring the radiation that will inevitably come from a very small earthquake off Japan, the way Fukushima is sitting now, completely hazardous, almost untouched as far as removing the very real danger of their stored rods catching fire.
All right, so it's radiation.
And we can't see we can see the stuff falling down, you know, the buildings falling down. We can't see the radiation coming, and I would really like to know what they're doing about monitoring the radiation from Fukushima. And thank you very much for the program.
All right, thanks for the question, Grumpy John. Anybody have any expertise here about any concerns about radiation coming from Fukushima, the nuclear power plant in Japan that failed with the earthquake and tsunami?
Well, I'll at least say that I do not know the details of the scope of that hazard, but when he talks about who's going to monitor it, under the emergency plan for the state of Oregon, the Oregon Health Authority is the lead state agency for any radiation emergency, except for those that come under the Department of Energy. And so that would be where a citizen who'd be interested or concerned about how it'd be done, contacting the responsible agency. But I'm not knowledgeable of the specific plans they have for the state of Oregon for things like that. But at least that's the responsible agency under Oregon plans.
Oregon Health Authority.
Well,
okay.
I have a little bit of experience in this because after the earthquake and the accident at Fukushima. Of course, people here in the Northwest were concerned about how much radiation was reaching us. And I have to say, I found the monitoring that was conducted by government agencies, states, and the EPA to be incredibly inadequate to answer the questions that people had. And up here, at least in Seattle, the best information we got was from a group of scientists at the University of Washington who just on their own decided to set up their own set up a monitoring system and to freely report the data that they got. So, I kind of wonder in the event of a really serious accident, which that really wasn't in terms of the amount of radiation that reached us, how good these monitoring systems are going to be.
All right. Well, a good grain of salt to put in there. Let's take a call from Dennis in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, my question is about who's going to be in charge. Why? I don't understand why the governor wouldn't be in charge, and he would instantly activate the National Guard and contact the President of the United States, who in turn would send, any help that we would need. I just see the military is the only group of people that actually understand how to handle something like this because they have a structure for dealing with, chain of command and that sort of thing. And a lot of the people that are out here have served in the military, so a lot of us would know how that chain of command would work. So it seems like to me that is the natural place to go for your...
Right, so just go start with the National Guard then. All right. Thanks for that, Dennis. Appreciate it. Bill Loki, thoughts on that, the National Guard and having it be the first line of defense in a disaster?
Yeah. Well, the National Guard is a marvelous resource, and he's absolutely correct. The governor has responsibilities under state law for, kind of being in charge of things, but also in our constitutional form of government, local communities, the executive elected officials in counties and cities, are in charge there, and the governor just doesn't take that over. The key is working together, but he's exactly right. Under the governor can declare states of emergency, institute a number of emergency authorities, can put the National Guard on duty to help. There's can be a tremendous amount of help from the U.S. military. The caller's exactly right. That organization, is the only one that's really got the structure and the organization to help out in something like this. But unless the president activates the Insurrection Act, under our Constitution, the local elected officials and the state elected officials, are ultimately in charge. The key is working out a plan of how we're going to work together to solve these problems. I've often thought who's in charge here is not as much an important question as how do we work together to solve these problems. But with our very complex society, with health officials in charge of certain things in health and fire officials in charge of suppressing fires and law enforcement in charge of law enforcement, the disaster tends to throw them all together. And it's very difficult without some pre-planning to divide up all the things that need to be done on the people that are responsible for them.
One of the things that Witt O'Brien's, your current company, does is tabletop exercises, doesn't it? So you're really getting a chance to test some systems and some communication avenues before something bad happens?
Oh, yes. And in exercising concepts today, that especially if you get federal money for it, the simpler exercises of what they call just a discussion seminar, sitting around the table and talking about it, and then it goes up through workshops and tabletops and up to full scale, we're actually rolling trucks and things like that. But just the sitting around a table and talking about how we intend to behave when these bad things happen is a good thing to do. And that needs to be done, in my opinion, around the dinner table at night with the family, around the, coffee break room at work, and among governments at the local level and state level and with the private sector. And with the nonprofits and with the private nonprofits like Red Cross and service agencies like that. You know, we're all going to be in this together. And the more we can spend time talking and whatnot, which circling back around to with the people who are coming to this conference and the discussions we'll have, it won't be just a number of speakers talking at them and lecturing them. A lot of this will be interactive with questions and, you know, talking about things and swapping business cards and making relationships, which is all positive in the continuum of getting our communities and our families and our organizations prepared.
Okay, about a minute left. Time to sneak in a call from Mike in Eagle Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. My hometown is Anchorage, Alaska. I was 17 years old when we experienced a 9.1 earthquake, and I always feel compelled when this discussion comes up to underline the need for individual preparedness. You're not going to have roads, railroads, seaports, airports, bridges are particularly vulnerable, utilities are going to be out. And if you could even get to a supermarket, the shelves are going to be empty. In this age of just-in-time restocking, there's no local warehousing. Having a couple of weeks of supplies, figure out what you're going to do about sanitation, fresh water, food, any kind of medical supplies that you might be in need of, heat, all of these things are going to be left to the individuals.
Think about where everything's going to come from. Okay, that's a good place to end, Mike. Thanks for the warning there. Rob Schwartz, just a final question. Is there a place for the public to come to the Emergency Preparedness Summit on Thursday in Springfield?
Absolutely. We're open not just to healthcare providers, whoever would like to come. We would love to have you. And I think your listeners got a flavor for the faculty and the quality of the faculty we will have there, because we truly feel blessed to have Bill and Sandy to present. They are really superb at what they do.
All right. Bill Loki, a senior program manager at Witt O'Brien, Sandy Doughton from the Seattle Times, Rob Schwartz, the executive director of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. And then tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the University of Oregon attempting to recruit some really bright students. We'll talk about the low rate of traffic deaths in Oregon, historically low. And then we'll talk to the author of the book Secrets and Lives. That's all tomorrow. Secrets and Lies, sorry. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please have a great day.